This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of New Books on Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host today, Jingyi Lee from the University of Arizona. In today's episode, we have Dr. Johanna Zueta with us to talk about her new book, Traditional Identities on Okinawa's Military Bases, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Dr. Zueta is currently an associate professor at Soka University in Japan, researching and teaching about sociology and anthropology. So this book explores the complexity and historical context of the identities of individuals that work on the U.S. military base in Okinawa, Japan. Many of these individuals have both Filipino and Okinawa heritage and find themselves caught in between the Japanese and Filipino society. By focusing on the role of migration in constructing these individuals' identities, Dr. Zueta discusses the transnationality of capital and network that were built around the bases. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you very much, Jingyi, for inviting me.
So this book is so very interesting. There's so much I want to ask you about, but before talking about your project, I'd like to get to know you a bit more. So what do you do and what brought you to Japanese studies?
Okay, so as you've introduced me a while ago, I am a sociologist and I teach sociology. And I also do research about Japan. So I also, you know, when I teach, most of my case studies are based on Japan. So what brought me to Japanese studies? I always tell people that it's an accident. I got interested in Japan because of, accidentally. That was because during my undergrad years, we were asked to register or to take up foreign language courses. And my first choice was actually Mandarin because of my ethnicity. And I don't know anything about China or Mandarin, but then the schedule wasn't really good. So it didn't, the Mandarin classes didn't fit my schedule. So I decided to take up Japanese instead, since my friends were also taking up Japanese. And it was, a popular choice during my time. And that was, I think, almost 20 years ago or more than 20 years ago. And so I took Japanese as a foreign language. I was a sophomore then in college. And then my teacher was really a very effective teacher. And then I began to learn, you know, as I was learning the language, I began to love the language. And also she would talk about the culture as well. And so because I was a sociology student during that time, I became interested in the complexities of Japanese society and culture, and especially with the mix of the traditional or old culture and the new high-tech culture. So I was pretty much young then. So that's how I saw Japan. And so I decided to take, a master's. I decided to go into graduate school to do more research about Japan. And I also did an exchange program. I came here for a year at ICU, International Christian University, to study the language more and also the culture more. And then I went back home, did my research, finished my first master's. And my thesis then was about the Okinawan community in the Philippines. But prior to that, I was more interested in the hidden Christians in Nagasaki. Being Christian myself, being Catholic myself, I became interested in that, you know, part of Japanese society. But then during that time, I couldn't do research. I couldn't come to Japan to do research. So I decided, and my professor also decided to just, you know, change my topic. And then she told me, you know, why don't you look into this Okinawan community in the Philippines, because it hasn't been looked into. And that started my interest in Okinawa when I was doing my first master's.
That's very fascinating that you have such a colorful background. And I think it's definitely reflected in your book, where you discuss these space workers who also have very colorful backgrounds. What part of Okinawa attracted you so much that you decided to write a book on it?
Okay, so what attracted me to Okinawa was the fact that, its place in Japanese society in the Japanese national polity as being marginalized because of its history, right? And because of its difference, its perceived cultural and ethnic difference. And when I was reading about Okinawan history, Okinawan culture, I realized that Okinawa is very, very different, and then that it's not really that well known in this part of the world. I mean, I was talking about Southeast Asia and the Philippines. So very, very few people know about it. So I said I have to do more research about it, and also, because I was interested in, until now, I am interested in issues about marginalization, ethnic identity, ethnicity difference. So that's what attracted me to Okinawa, and I decided to do more research on it. And I decided to come to Japan to do my graduate studies. And after that, when I came to Japan, Hitotsubashi, to do my, well, it's my second MA and a PhD, I decided to look more into this issue and focus on the base workers in Okinawa, who are actually half Filipino and half Okinawans. Their mothers are Okinawans, because this issue is not very much well known in Japan as well as in the Philippines and probably worldwide. And that led me to do more research on Okinawa and, you know, what led to the current book project.
That's really great. And I definitely agree that this issue of Okinawa-based workers aren't receiving enough attention, whether in academia or in society, in the media. We often see in the news when there is another protest around the base, security issues that many of these protests are around. but none of them mention who are actually working on these bases. So you mention in the book that the role that immigration played in the years that the U.S. military base was built and maintained in Okinawa. Could you give us more details about this immigration process and especially how Filipino workers got involved in this process?
Okay, thank you for that question. I argued in the book that, you know, military basing in Okinawa, the occupation of Okinawa, the American occupation of Okinawa should be seen as a transnational project. Because in studies about Okinawa, particularly about the U.S. military bases, it's usually seen as an issue between the U.S. and Japan, right? U.S. and Japanese governments. So it's pretty much seen in that kind of dichotomy. But I also, it's usually seen from a more international relations perspective or political science or historical perspective. But I chose to see it as I've mentioned, it's a transnational project. I also chose to see it from the perspective of migration because it also engendered a lot of migration within the region, especially during the occupation of Okinawa when you, of course, military basing needs workers to construct the base. And you have the Americans, you have the local nationals, meaning the Okinawans themselves, and they also had to hire so-called third country nationals or people who are outside Okinawa and who are non-American and non-Okinawan. So they hired people from the Philippines, from India, people from all over the world, I think even including mainland China and even Taiwan, to work on the construction of the bases as well as to staff the bases as, you know, workers such as engineers, such as store clerks. And many of these people came from the Philippines because the Philippines was an American colony. And obviously, because of 5 decades of colonial rule, Filipinos are proficient in the language, in English, as well as they are familiar with American cultural norms. So in a way, they were actually favored along with the Indians, Indian nationals. And so there were a lot of Filipinos who went to Okinawa to work on base, both for the construction and the staffing of bases. And this was also, of course, an agreement between the U.S. government, the U.S. occupation government, and the Philippine government. And when I was doing research for this book, I also did archival research and looked at some unclassified documents or, you know, letters, state-to-state agreements between the Philippines and the U.S. occupation government asking, I mean, about sending migrant labor. And these, as I've mentioned, these migrant labor, they were called third country nationals during that time because they were not Japanese, they were not Okinawans, and they were not Americans. And so I argued that in the book that it's pretty much transnational and we have to look at it from a migration perspective as well, because it's because of the American occupation of Okinawa that you had a lot of these migrations happening during that time. And that was the post-war years, right? Late 1940s to 50s. So that's it.
Wow, I was really surprised actually when reading the book, because I had never thought that apart from the military base being on Okinawa land, taking Okinawa resources and using Okinawa labor, I never really think about the I guess in a way it's the results from colonialism, how it's still affecting people who were a part of that colonialism. So in the beginning of our little chat, I summarized your book really briefly. Could you tell us or summarize more of the book for us, the part that you explore the identities of third country nationals on the basis?
Okay, yes. I think in some chapters of the book, I talked about the identities of these base workers. And as I also mentioned, and I think you also mentioned last time, that many of these base workers that I interviewed are Japanese nationals. So in effect, they're not anymore third country nationals because they're Japanese. Legally, they're Japanese nationals, and they are part of the so-called United States Forces in Japan employees. So they're basically, yes, employees of the working for the United States Forces in Japan. And with regards to nationality, for these people, I argued in the book that when we talk about Japanese nationality, we have to challenge what that means, because we always think of nationality in the Japanese sense as a conflation of ethnicity, citizenship, culture, language. But then, you know, with regards to Japanese nationality, now who is a Japanese? Right? We always ask that question, who is a Japanese? It's pretty complex now, especially now that you have these so-called half individuals who are Japanese legally, but probably culturally they are not Japanese anymore because they might not be proficient in the language, or they do not know a lot of Japanese cultural norms, or they are actually one of their parents is not Japanese. And this is what I dealt with in the book, that if you look at, let's say, base workers, many or most of them are Japanese. You know, those civilian workers. I also mentioned in the book that most of these bases are actually right now being supported by the Japanese government in terms of, you know, financial resources, and they also pay for the civilian workers on base, the Japanese workers on base. And for these Japanese workers on base, when you look at their nationality, of course they're Japanese, but then if you look at their background, many of them are, you know, they actually have Okinawan and Filipino parentage. And by looking at this case, we can also look into the complexities of Japanese nationality and who a Japanese is or who an Okinawan is, right? That we have to veer away from that perspective of seeing a Japanese or an Okinawan as, if I may use the word, pure, because, you know, times are changing, and because of U.S. military basing, these people who are so-called half were actually born. Yeah, that's it.
Wow, there's so much in what you just said that I want to get more details about. So I guess I can start with this question. So you mentioned, and this I actually did not know before you mentioned it, that the Japanese government is actually paying for these base workers, even though they're working for U.S. military bases. I guess this ties into my next question. In Chapter 6, you introduce how these base workers fit into the labor system of both Japan and the U.S. So could you give us a bit more overview of this labor system, and why are these issues, what are some issues that this might bring when it comes to these base workers with Filipino and Japanese heritage?
Okay, thank you for that. Yes, in Chapter 6, I talked about how these base workers are hired. And then there's this special agency, the Labor Management Organization, which is tasked to hire USFJ employees or United States Forces in Japan employees. So they are hired by the Japanese government through the Ministry of Defense. It seems that they are government workers, but they are not really considered komuin or civil servants. They are of a different type of workers, but they are, of course, funded by the Japanese government, meaning they get their salaries from the Japanese government. And how this plays into the whole base issue or military basing, because they are needed to support. They're actually the support force for the United States military in Japan, because they're the ones doing all the technical work, whether it's IT, whether it's working in restaurants, in shops within the base, whether you also have people working in recreational facilities on base. So you also need these workers there. So without them, the bases could not function, because it's like one big society, or if we can use that term, wherein you have the military and you also have the civilian workers making things work for US forces in Japan, stationed in Japan. So it's really going to be tough. Again, this is a very much contentious issue, because many people want to get rid of the bases in Okinawa. So if we talk about Okinawa, you have people saying, we have to get rid of the bases here in Okinawa. We don't need the bases. But then, on the other hand, the bases also provide jobs for many of these Okinawans. And in fact, in Okinawa, a base job is like, they use the term akogare, meaning it's being longed for. So unlike in the mainland, wherein they don't really care much about base work, in Okinawa, people would want to work on base because it pays well, especially for the base towns or towns in Okinawa wherein they host the bases, such as Okinawa City, Ginowan City, even a town as small as Kin, K-I-N. Many of these, the people living near these bases, they usually work inside the bases, or they have businesses that cater to the U.S. military. So it's really part of Okinawan society. It's really part of their livelihood. So it's really a big issue when you talk about labor, because it's really income generating for many Okinawans, and a lot of them work there. So take away the bases, what will happen? And this is also what my informants told me, that they are pro base, because their livelihood depends on the bases. And they even told me that during elections, they vote for people who are officials who or politicians who are pro-base, because obviously they want the bases to be maintained, because their livelihood counts on it. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, that's astonishing to know. Is this, do you think the same or a similar situation is happening on to base workers of the other military bases in Japan, or is it a special case for Okinawa?
Yes, that's a good question. I mentioned earlier that in the case of the mainland, not much people are really bent on working on base. That's also due to the fact that if you look at the bases on the mainland, they're very much dispersed from Hokkaido to Kyushu. Okay. But in Okinawa, you have almost 70% of all the U.S. bases in Japan in that small island of Okinawa. And we also know that unemployment rate in Okinawa is pretty much high. The last time I checked, it's higher than the national average. And on the mainland, you have a lot of job opportunities. It's not only the bases. In Okinawa, especially for the generation now, right? The current generation, they were already born with this environment around them that they live alongside the bases. And yes, because base work pays more. So it's one of the few options available for them. Of course, there's also tourism. And also, yeah, it's either that or they leave the prefecture and work in the mainland, which many of them are doing. And so because of less opportunities compared to the mainland, the bases are a source of, it's a significant source of job opportunities. So it's not only working inside the bases, but also, you know, if they have, let's say, businesses that cater to the Americans, the servicemen and women, then we can also argue that, yeah, they depend on the bases for their livelihood. So yeah, I hope that's clear.
So would you then consider this as one of the main reasons that the issues concerning base workers aren't receiving enough attention from the Japanese society, that that in the mainland or outside of the base, outside of Okinawa, they don't have to worry about the opportunities that's brought by the bases?
Yes, I think that's one. And also, yeah, because in the mainland you have more opportunities, and also I think base work is actually hidden because bases are, people see it as an enclave. Like, you don't actually know what's going on there. Not anyone can enter, just freely enter the bases. So for people in the mainland, the way I see it, they don't know what's happening inside the bases. Even in Okinawa, you can't just enter these bases unless you have like a permit or you work inside the bases. So that's why I think people are not that conscious about base workers, especially in the mainland, because as I've said, bases are dispersed. Unless you live in a town where, or which hosts the military base, or let's say like Yokosuka in Kanagawa Prefecture, or Tokyo also has Yokota Air Base, which is in Fusa City. So people surrounding that, so probably they know people working on base. Unlike in Okinawa, where you are actually literally surrounded by a lot of these military installations, so it's like a part of life that your neighbor or probably one of your kin or family member works on base. So that's also what I felt when doing research in Okinawa, right? People here and there, they work on base or they know someone who works on base. So it's pretty much, because it's a very much ubiquitous existence as compared to the mainland. Unless, of course, you're living close to one of these military installations. And again, the military installations in the mainland are quite dispersed compared to the ones in Okinawa.
That's right. I can't begin to imagine how different life must be for not just base workers, but also, like you say, people whose family members are base workers. And I understand that from the book, I understand that a large part of your research is not just on the labor system constituting the whole base worker labor system, but also the internal struggles of these base workers. So you look at them not just as a generic group of base workers, but they are actual persons who, like your book writes, are struggling, and in this particular case, struggling between their Filipino heritage and their identity as partially Japanese, perhaps partially connected to still third country nationals. Can you tell us more about the complexity of their identities and why it's such an important issue when we consider the role of U.S. military bases in Japan?
Okay, thank you for that. Yes, this is, in the book, I argue that they are, that my informants are the other to the emigration. And if you talk about the emigration, especially in Okinawa, it's a very contentious issue because, well, first, what is an emigration? An emigration is someone who is, or who was born to an American serviceman, usually male, and then an Asian woman. And this is because of military basing in Asia. So you have Vietnamese emigrations, you have Korean emigrations, you have Japanese emigrations, you have Filipino emigrations. And so you have this group of individuals who were born because of the presence of the U.S. military bases in the region. But I also argue that beyond this or beneath this emigration category, you also have people who were born because of military basing, but then their fathers were not Americans. Rather, they are, let's say, Indians or Filipinos, but they worked alongside the Americans, the Allied forces. So I said in the book that they are the other to the emigrations. And for these individuals of Okinawan and Filipino parentage, again, their mothers are Okinawans, their fathers are Filipinos who worked on base. There are a lot of issues in terms of, or with regards to their identity. One is growing up in Okinawa as a child of, you know, a Filipino and an Okinawan mother. Although, even though they are not conspicuously different, meaning they don't physically look different as compared to when you are, let's say, half Caucasian or half Black. So in a way, they're not that conspicuous. But in terms of language, for instance, right? So in terms of language, many of them are not familiar with the Japanese language, especially when they returned. So that's an issue when they returned as adults. When they were growing up, some of them, I remembered I told about the story of Marco, who was schooled in an international school, but he was actually speaking Japanese at home. But then while speaking Japanese at home, he had a Filipino name. So that really disturbed his identity. Imagine going to an international school speaking English, but at home they speak in Japanese, but then he has a Filipino name. So he was questioning, he had all these questions about his identity. And then for those who they grew up in Okinawa, they grew up in Okinawa, but they had to go to the Philippines, their dad's homeland, because the contracts, the work contracts of their fathers expired. So for those who went home in the 50s, they also experienced discrimination because of the atrocities committed by the Japanese. And the Filipinos thought that they were actually half Japanese and that they're connected to the war atrocities that the Japanese soldiers committed in that part of the world. So they also had that bullying issue, discrimination. And then coming back as adults when they were in their 20s or in their 30s to work on base, while on base, they were not really discriminated against. So far, they did not tell me anything about discrimination, but they told me that because they do not know or they are not familiar or not fluent in Japanese. Outside, they were treated as foreigners, even though they have Japanese nationality. And then, yeah, they, as I described them in the book, they are legally Japanese, but culturally they are not, because yeah, culturally they act differently. They also somehow imbibed base culture. So whatever the culture is on base, which is pretty much American, but also multicultural. So on base, they are able to, you know, be, let's say, themselves, because they can easily interact with the Americans and with the other Japanese or Okinawans who speak English. But then outside, it's a totally different world for them. That is why in one of the chapters, I think one quote that stood out, or when I was interviewing these my informants, Rafael mentioned that we Okinawans are a minority in Okinawa and we are a minority in Okinawa. So it's like we are a minority within a minority. So a double minority status in Okinawa, because Okinawans are a minority in the whole of Japan and then they are a minority in Okinawa. So that's what I discuss in the book, double minority. And I also mentioned that these people are invisible, primarily because not many people know about their existence. That you know you have these base workers who are actually half Japanese or half Okinawan, half Filipinos. Although in Okinawa, many of them, in Okinawa, their existence is kind of known because Okinawans live among them. But then generally speaking, I said they are invisible in that regard, because not many people know about them. So I hope I answered that question.
Thank you. That must be so difficult for these people to be struggling, to be torn between the Japanese society, Japanese culture, and their own culture. Or if they even feel that they belong to any of their own culture. And you just mentioned some examples, some individuals. And from your book, I can tell that you did a lot of interviews on these base workers. Are there any story that stood out in particular to you when you were exploring this issue?
Yes, I mentioned the issue, or I mentioned the story of Marco, who, yeah, the person I mentioned earlier who studied in an international school, but he was talking to his parents, to his Okinawan mother and Filipino father in Japanese at home, but then he had a Filipino name, so he was quite puzzled about his identity, and it was at a very young age. And then I also mentioned Rafael. Rafael, he was talking to me about being born in Okinawa and had to move to the Philippines when he was still a child. And when he came back to, when he came back to Okinawa, he said he needed some documents to go back to his home. Because it was still, it was already, I think, during the reversion period. And he also mentioned about being given an automatic citizenship or passport, Japanese nationality, because his mother is Okinawan. And it's not only that, it's also connected to the fact that these individuals were listed in their mother's family registry, or in Japanese, it's called Koseki Tohon. I also mentioned in the book that nationality has become automatic for these individuals, primarily for those who were born out of wedlock, so illegitimate. And they even told me that I was able to acquire Japanese nationality because I was born before my parents got married. And because they were born before their parents got married, so they were listed under their mother's family registry. Because during that time, that was in the 1950s, if you were born with a foreign father, then, and you were born with a foreign father after your parents married, then you take on the nationality of the father. So that means, especially, and some of these individuals are not registered in under their mother's kosekitohon. And because of that, it would be difficult to claim Japanese nationality after your parents get married. So you really have to prove that your mother is Okinawan. And I also came across some of my informants who had that kind of problem. But for those who were born before their parents got married, it was somehow much easier because they just presented the documents and then the officials, the immigration officials, saw that, okay, they are listed under their mother's family registry, so they are Japanese. And so it was easy for them. That is what, and even one of them said that it's automatic. So those were the stories that I heard, and that it was really interesting because they were talking about how illegitimacy, in a way, made it easier for them to acquire Japanese nationality. And because of that, I also, looked at some other cases. And there were, in fact, other cases that are similar because of the Japanese nationality law during that time, which was, of course, changed now. But before, because of that, because of the law, and then, So in a way, because they were born before their parents got married, so the law did not apply to them, and so they were able to acquire Japanese nationality by virtue of being listed in their mother's kosekito. So those were some of the stories that's connected to nationality and also identity. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, of course. It's just, this is such a complicated issue with so many layers to unpack. And I am really amazed how you were able to explain all of these very neatly in your book. I really wish we had more time to discuss your book, but allow me to just ask one last question. So, looking into the future for these base workers, what do you think are some possible ways that the Japanese society can do, or maybe even the world can do, to help solve the identity crises of base workers? And how do you think this barrier between the base and the other side, outside of the base, could be broken?
Okay. Thank you for that question. That's really a thought-provoking question. So for the identities of my informants, my base worker informants, in my book, I call them Nisei, or second generation in Japanese, primarily because that's also how they identify themselves as Nisei, meaning their Issei mother is Okinawan, and so they are Nisei, meaning second generation Okinawan. So they got that term from that, from their Okinawan parentage. That's why they use the term Nisei. So in the case of the identity of these kinds of base workers, especially for the next generation of base workers, the Sansei, many of these Niseis have, children who work on base now. Yeah, because the Nisei, my informants have retired or are soon to retire. And so the next generation may also have these issues about identity. I think what is important to note is that, when you talk about workers, these kinds of civilian workers on base, and then even though we know that they're Japanese, we also have to to think who really is Japanese, what is our understanding of Japanese, because just seeing this case of these Nisei base workers, they're actually half, and they're not, and I'm pretty sure you also have a lot of these kinds of, or different kinds of half, maybe half Japanese, half Americans working on bases or working on base in Okinawa. And so that challenges to think about identity from a Japanese perspective or a Japanese context. And also, yeah, with regards to looking at, or how do we tear down the walls between the bases and, let's say, local society. Looking from an Okinawan perspective, or the context of Okinawa, yes, it's really difficult because, as I've said, the bases are an enclave, so we don't really know what is happening on base. It's a complex issue in Okinawa because, on the one hand, people who work on base are admired because, you know, they are able to live quite, you know, good lives in terms of, I mean, financially, like not, yeah, middle class, affluent lives. But at the same time, some people don't have good, maybe they don't see base work as a good thing, especially if they're anti-base, because they see that people who work on base, oh, they're probably pro-base. So you have that really contentious issue. And again, people who work alongside the military in Okinawa, right, as civilian workers, or if they're married to a serviceman, they're also seen differently. And you have all these works, you know, talking about these kinds of issues. So how do we tear down the walls? I think it's I think more awareness is needed, and people should look at this base issue as a really complex thing, and we shouldn't just look at it from an anti or a pro base perspective, but there are a lot of issues that's connected to this particular topic. On the one hand, you also have the U.S. military trying to reach out to the Okinawan community by learning more about, I think, about Okinawa. But I know that there are some activities that these servicemen or the bases they try to reach out to the community where they're in. So, for example, they also have like open base, how do you call it? Some sort of like an open house event wherein they open the bases to locals so that the locals can enter. And these, I don't know if it happened last year because of COVID, but they hold these kinds of events. So yes, and also I think it's really, I don't really, because I don't live in Okinawa, so I think it's mostly trying to reach an understanding between people who are outside the bases and people who work on base. So trying, I think it's more really information, and that's why I also wrote this book, because when we talk about the base, where we always think about the military, and especially if we talk about Okinawa and the base issue, it's always okay, U.S. military committing atrocities. But then, what about the people who make their living inside the bases? What do they think about the bases? And so, and what are they? What are they experiencing? So that's why I wrote about this book, which was, you know, which was which is a culmination of my graduate school years. my graduate school research to hopefully inform people that, you know, you have these civilian workers, and this is how they think about the base issue, and this is how they think about Okinawan society, this is how they think about being Okinawan, being Japanese, and this is just one part of the story. And hopefully we can you know, promote this sort of coexistence among these people, among these entities in Okinawa. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I think that was great to hear. I definitely think that your work is very important. I'm so glad that you're writing this book and calling for more attention on this issue, and that, well, I guess there are, in some way, efforts to connect the base and the outside of the base. I definitely hope that your research receive more attention, not just from academia, but also from ordinary, I can't really say ordinary people, but media and just everyday people.
Yes, thank you, Jingyi. And yes, that's why I also agreed to do this podcast. So hopefully my research will also reach out to a lot of people, because so far I've been talking to academics, if not academics, students. So, I mean, to a larger audience, I still think I need to do more work so as to make people more aware about this issue. Thank you.
I believe that will definitely happen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for telling us all about this issue that so few people know about. It was really a pleasure reading your book, and I learned so much from your book.
Yeah, same here. It's been a pleasure to, you know, talk to you about my book, and thank you very much for those questions. I think they're very much important questions.
Thank you. And for our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about immigration and workers on the U.S. military bases of Okinawa, make sure to check out this book, Traditional Identities on Okinawa's Military Bases. This is Jingyi Lee from New Books on Japanese Studies. Until our next episode, goodbye.